Hello and welcome to the Field Guides. I'm Bill and I'm here with Steve. Good afternoon, Steve.
Good afternoon, Bill.
And I'm here with Daniel. Good afternoon, Daniel.
How are we doing, Bill?
I'm doing all right. And what we're going to do today and over the course of many future episodes is give you the idea of what it's like to be in the woods, in the field, and on the trail. Each episode, we'll pick a natural history topic, research the science behind that topic, and then take you out to a natural spot and share with you everything that we've learned. And today, I want you guys to answer this question. What would you think most of our listeners would think if I said, we are looking for a plant that does not have chlorophyll and that parasitizes fungus and trees in the woods?
Oh, like what would people guess?
Yeah, what would people guess?
Ghost pipes? I was going to say, long-time listeners might not think it's ghost pipe because they're doing it again.
Exactly. That's why I brought it up.
Beach drops.
That's a good guess too. So, folks, we are looking for a plant called pine sap today, and I've actually brought us to a section of Chestnut Ridge Park here in Western New York. This is a site we've recorded at before. And this is a plant I have never seen in person before. Have you guys seen it?
Wait, I think I've seen it.
A plant called pine sap?
Yes.
I thought you literally meant we were going to be talking about the sap of pines
today. Oh, no.
No.
Wow. Okay. All right. Exciting.
So yeah. I don't think Daniel's seen it before either.
No.
I think I've seen it. I don't know.
You think you have?
Yeah.
All right. So let's stop here because we're walking on a trail, folks, through some, what we'd say, mostly oak. There's some hemlock. There's some beech.
Yeah, a lot of beech, yeah.
And this spot that we're standing on, I checked on iNaturalist and I tried to find pine sap sightings in the area. And there were several sightings from this patch of woods. Actually, the patch of woods that I'm looking into right now. Now, I did come and scout here yesterday with my wife and daughter, but it was a little buggy for them. So I feel like I was the only one doing most of the searching. And they tolerated maybe 20 minutes of searching and they were ready to go. So we did not get as much searching as I wanted in. But before we start searching, I want to give folks a little background on the plant. We mentioned ghost pipe, one of its relatives. Mm-hmm. It was formerly called Indian pipe. So pine sap looks similar. So it's also called Dutchman's pipe. It's been called false beech drops or yellow bird's nest. And in most part of its range, it's a rare find. So it has a widespread range. We're going to talk about that. But typically, wherever you can find it, it's going to be hard to find.
Oh, like it has a wide range, but it's... And it can be locally abundant, but it's rare.
Correct.
Yeah.
So it's scarce to rare in many parts of its range. So it's found in temperate regions of the Northern Hemisphere, and it has a huge range. Like here in North America, it grows all the way from Alaska all the way down to Central America. And it can be found across Europe, Asia, and North Africa.
Wow.
Now, if you're familiar with ghost pipe, as I said, it looks very similar, but ghost pipe has one flower per stem, whereas pine sap has many flowers. It can have 1 to 11 flowers. Pine sap is going to be yellowish white or reddish pink or anywhere in between, and it's topped with that cluster of flowers, like I mentioned. You're usually going to find one color, form, or the other. We're going to get more into this. And there are intermediate ones. So if you look up pictures online, you'll see ones that are all kind of a creamy yellow color. And then you'll see ones where all parts of the plant are kind of a deep crimson or a deep red. And then there's some in between where the stalk is more cream-colored, but the bracts, the little scales on it, are red. So there's intermediate forms as well.
I had no idea that you should expect one or the other. I didn't realize that.
They can grow in the same locality, but their timing is different. We'll talk about that. The stalk is usually 10 to 25 centimeters high. It's fleshy. A lot of people mistake it for a fungus because it doesn't look like a flower. Again, similar to ghost pipe. The flowers themselves are a little more than a centimeter long, so they're smaller than what you're used to seeing with ghost pipe. And they're shaped like an elongated pipe bowl, kind of flared at the end. Sometimes it's referred to as an elongated urn. Think of a blueberry flower.
Okay. Yeah.
And it looks...
The typical bell look with it flares out a little bit.
Flares out at the end.
Yeah.
Do you know why it looks like that?
I actually don't know why.
They're all in Ericaceae.
Oh, right,
yeah,
right.
We're going to talk about that.
I thought it was going to be deeper than that.
No, that's it.
Like, I don't know an evolutionary thing. Is this a story we're making up again? Or?
So again, at the top of each stem, you're going to have 1 to 11 flowers. But that stalk isn't really, it's not a stem, because what comes up out of the ground is a raceme. And Steve, some people call it a raceme, I don't know how you pronounce it, but Do you know what a raceme is? Do you remember from your more botanical
days? I know,
my
botanical days. Isn't it raceme? It's actually a part, isn't it part of the flower morphology itself, right?
So it's a flower cluster with separate flowers attached by short, equal stalks at equal distances along a central stem.
So would like the, what is it, the umbellaceae, like carrots and stuff, is that, would that be a raceme?
No, because that's round.
Okay.
Think of lily of the valley.
Oh, okay.
Or wild black cherry flowers. If you can think of their flower heads, it's that long white.
Okay.
So it's usually one stem, and you're going to have flowers sometimes on one side, sometimes on both sides.
Okay.
But what comes up out of the ground for pine sap, what's called the inflorescence, that's, the whole thing is the flower. It's not like a stalk. It's not like a stem coming up with then flowers growing off of it.
Yeah, that's strange.
That's the flowering part of the plant.
I guess if you, I know we didn't fully explain what it looks like, but if you're looking at it, if you're picturing it, you can't really distinguish between what would be like the stalk and then where the flower, like where does the flower start and the, you know, and the,
yeah,
the rest of the
technically like the whole thing is.
The whole thing is.
Inflorescence, yeah.
Interesting.
Now, there are small, as I mentioned, scale-like bracts on the stem and on the flowers. Those are modified and reduced leaves, and the flowers bend downward when it's young. But as the flowers mature, they start to swing perpendicular to the ground. And then after it's pollinated, the flowers develop into a seed capsule and the flowers become erect. And then those dried capsules and stalks persist through the winter, usually into the next growing season. And everything I've just mentioned is very similar to ghost pipe.
Yeah. I mean, if you see like the previous season's old dried up husks of a plant, they are like sticking upwards, right? Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
That's something I never actually really thought much about before.
Yep.
But yeah. You know what? This is really related. Did we talk about this in the other Monotropa episode, what Monotropa means?
We're going to talk about that.
Okay.
But
I won't go into it.
Why don't you go into it now? Because the scientific name of pine sap, I haven't mentioned that yet, is Monotropa. I say Hypopitis, but would you say Hypopides?
Either one.
Yeah. So Monotropa, what does it mean?
One turn. Monotropa. So mono, one, tropa, turn.
One turn. And there's lots of explanations about what that could refer to. Some people say it refers to the fact that it just has, the flowers are bent.
Oh, that's what I was thinking.
There's one. But I've also heard it said that it refers to the fact that it makes one turn and points up once the seeds are ready.
Yeah.
Here in North America.
And then the specific epithet?
Oh.
Hypo?
Hypopitis.
Under?
Under, do you know?
Pitis pine.
Very good.
Yeah.
So very often you can find them under pines, but not all the time.
Yeah, it's not their only host.
But. Yeah. Now, folks, I feel like I should mention that where we're standing, it is supposed to rain. It looks like pretty hard in about a half an hour, so we'll see how it goes.
So hopefully we get that on mic.
Talk fast.
Yeah.
Talk fast.
I want them to talk slow.
May have to pause, but we'll go as long as we can.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to talk about the flowering season, but I feel like we should talk a little bit about where we are, because I mentioned it very briefly. We're in Chestnut Ridge Park. This is a county park about 20 minutes, half hour southeast of Buffalo. We've recorded a few episodes here before.
The Eternal Flame is nearby, which we've recorded some episodes at, too.
Yep.
Bioluminescent fungi episode.
That's right. Very good. I think we recorded your hawk episode here, right? The sharp-shinned hawk?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a different part of the park. But
yep.
Yeah.
So we're actually in a part of the park I have not been in before. And as I said, we'll go out in the woods in a few minutes and we'll do some searching. When we were here yesterday, there is a plant that my wife cited first that I have rarely seen in Western New York. So even if we don't find pine sap, we'll get to see a plant that I think is very
cool.
This
is exciting.
Yeah, this is really good.
So pine sap, it flowers May through October. So think about that. May through October. That is a long flowering season, right? Plants flowering in late spring and summer, near the beginning of the range, are yellow, sparsely hairy, and those that flower later, especially into the fall, are red and densely hairy. But remember, there is an overlap in flowering time. It's been suggested that those yellow individuals, and when I say yellow, it's really more of like a creamy yellow, they're largely self-pollinating.
Oh.
And that this, along with the differences in flowering time, and there's some other factors, might be evidence that those two color forms are separate species. We're going to get into that more when we talk taxonomy. Now, notice I did not mention green in this plant's description because, like other members of Monotropa and even of its subfamily, it doesn't contain chlorophyll. And I asked you this in the ghost pipe episode. What do you call plants that don't have chlorophyll? Do you remember?
I don't remember what we called it.
Achlorophyllus.
Oh, pretty self-explanatory.
Just it.
About to say
A as in not. Oh. Yeah.
So instead, it's a mycoheterotroph. So break that down for us, guys.
What myco, mushroom, or fungi.
Fungi.
Heterotroph, that's where, heterotrophic is where, that's where the energy is
generated. Yeah, they get it from somebody else, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to a?
Autotroph.
Yeah. So they're getting their nutrients from fungus. They're getting it through
Parasitism.
From a
parrot.
That's
when you become a parrot.
Not editing that out.
Parasitism. Upon specific fungi instead of using that photosynthesis. So these fungi that they're tapping into, they're the ones that form a mutualism with nearby tree species. Mutualism, both are benefiting, right? So these are the mycorrhizal fungi. So we're going to pause here just to identify. I imagine a lot of our listeners know about mycorrhizal fungi, but what do you know, guys?
Mycorrhizal?
Yeah.
It's in the soil.
And all the trees are getting along and sharing what they need with.
Yeah. I've seen the secret
Avatar,
lights of plants.
So they can like, kind of communicate with each other. Yeah.
We are joking, folks.
I also do think plants have feelings.
So I'm sure you guys will back me up that. Mycorrhizal fungi over the past couple decades have often, that whole relationship between the fungi and the trees has been characterized as somewhat simplistically as kind of trees sharing nutrients. And I would recommend everybody check out In Defense of Plants. They've done several episodes bringing in experts talking on what the science actually says as opposed to what's often being reported in the media. And there's still so much we don't understand and don't know about what is happening in that fungal network. But we do know that pine sap and other of its relatives are tapping into that. So mycorrhizae, and just to say it very simply, they're symbiotic fungi that colonize tree roots. They provide the tree roots with nutrients and water in exchange for carbohydrates. Trees probably could grow without mycorrhizae, but they're not going to do it as well. And really to have the forests and the habitats that we're familiar with, that wildlife depend on, that mycorrhizal fungi is a key component of it. So this fungal network, it also increases plant establishment. So just young seedlings that are trying to establish a foothold, the mycorrhizae help with that. And they extend the root's surface area for better uptake of minerals and nutrients, and they also boost resistance to stress. And again, I'm just giving a very surface overview of what this all relationship is all about. So by virtue of this, pine sap is a parasitic plant. More specifically, it's what we would call a non-photosynthetic mycorrhizal epiparasite, because it's parasitizing the fungi that is then attached to the tree. So it's a three-part relationship there. Now, before this was known, it took over 100 years for scientists to figure out what the hell was going on with these plants. At first, they were thought to be saprophytes. Do you remember what those are?
That's what I was going to ask about.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's what I heard the ghost pipes were, saprophytes.
Right. And when I first learned about them, that's what I was taught
as
well.
Is it nutrients from, like, decaying matter?
Yep, exactly. Okay. Or they were thought maybe they were parasitizing the roots of trees. But no evidence of either of those things could be found.
So ghost pipes are not.
They are not saprophytes. So ghost pipes, pine saps, all what we call the monotropes, they are tapping into the fungi that are then attached to the trees.
As opposed to saprophytes are?
Saprophytes are just feeding off dead and decaying matter in the soil. So dead leaves, dead anything in the soil. Okay. So eventually, they figured out that it's pine sap and its relatives were tapping not into host plants, but into the mycorrhizal associates. The first plant that was reported ID'd as a mycoheterotroph was pine sap.
Oh, wow.
At least in my relationship. This was kind of the one that
plant.
Helped people figure it out. So we're going to talk about taxonomy now. I know usually I do this a little later, but I feel like we need to establish some information before we really get into it. So we've already talked about what Monotropa hypopides means, once turned and under pines. Now, Linnaeus did misspell the species epithet as hypopithes. Hypopithes. And that has been repeated. So sometimes you'll see sources that list it that way. The variability in pine sap's color and hairiness, the number of flowers, it's led to an extensive list of synonyms. So one source I said there's over 80 different scientific names for this plant.
It's messy.
So there's a lot of confusion. Some current that I found list Hypopitus as the genus and then Monotropa as the species.
Well, especially with such a large range, it makes sense there would just be so many different names for it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. So with DNA analysis, we are getting a clearer view of where we're at. But if you look online, you're going to see a lot of conflicting information about what the Latin name actually is.
Wow.
And it's kind of scary because I know I'm looking on social media, but when I looked just for quick, I was honestly looking for how to pronounce it because I couldn't find a reliable dictionary website.
Yeah.
So I was just looking on social media. And almost all of the videos I saw, no one actually says the name. It's just listed as, you know, text on the video.
That's funny.
There were so many. I'd say at least half the videos I looked at were showing pine sap, but they called it ghost pipe.
Oh.
Like, oh, look, I found some ghost pipe here.
Interesting. Yeah.
That would be me.
All right. So be careful when you're looking online. Obviously, I feel that doesn't even need to be said. While currently included in the genus Monotropa, recent genetic evidence strongly suggests that pine sap should be placed in its own genus.
Whoa.
So it was at one time in its own genus, then it was moved into Monotropa, but recent evidence is suggesting maybe it should be moved back.
I wonder if it's saying, so when you say that, what I think of is, let's say you have a bunch of different species that you're throwing into like a tree, like a phylogeny to see what's related to what. And to me, it seems like if this species, so is there a non-monotropa that's more closely related to the rest of the monotropa than it is to, this species is to those?
Apparently not, because that's why they think it should have its own.
But that's what I'm saying. So is there a non-monotropa that's more closely related to the rest of the monotropa than this one is to the rest?
I don't think so.
Why would it have its own genus then?
Because it's different enough from from ghost pipe?
I want to see this phylogeny.
I guess. I'm totally guessing. You know more about this than I do.
I want to see it, but...
But it goes even further, and we'll get into it, because some people say that pine sap needs to be separated into many species, not just two.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now, all this led me to a paper. It was actually a dissertation that someone did, and it was an interesting dissertation because it had four different chapters, and it was almost like they did four different studies on plants within the monotrope family. Okay. And I will point out more in a few minutes, but there's Monotropa.
Wait, do you mean four different species within the Monotropa genus?
Let me finish.
You said Monotropa family. I just wanted to make sure that we're being clear.
That's what I was just going to say.
Okay.
Because it can be confusing, folks. So right now, pine sap and ghost pipe, their genus is Monotropa. They can be referred to as the monotropes, which is the larger subfamily, okay?
Oh.
Which we'll get into, which includes other plants that have other genera.
Yeah. Okay.
All right? And we'll get more into that. I feel like we're getting into the weeds here, which I don't want to say.
Bill's going to get tackled if he keeps making these statements.
So the dissertation I'm talking about, there were four different studies, almost. There were four chapters, and they were trying to find different things out. All included plants like ghost pipe, pine saps, and their relatives.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so all of these non-photosynthetic parasitic mycoheterotrophs. Because there has not been that much research into like their flowering times, their genetics. So the one that I looked at, the chapter that I looked at, focused on comparing...
Folks, sorry, it's getting dark in a cool way right now.
Yeah. Steve and I are like looking around.
I felt a few drops already.
It's getting very dark right now. I don't know
I
if
like
you,
it.
Everyone can hear the wind. I don't.
No, it's pretty good.
Pretty protected, yeah.
So we'll see.
Just got a drop. Should we, while you talk, backtrack to that shelter?
Nah.
Come on.
Okay, fine. I'm holding equipment right now.
I have an umbrella, Daniel.
Oh, we got an umbrella.
Daniel can hold the umbrella if he needs to.
All right, folks, we got to keep that in, though.
So the part of the study that I was interested in, they looked at ghost pipe and pine sap populations for 3 years, including the different color forms. So they relied a lot on field observations and then different manipulations or experiments of those populations, really focusing on different aspects of plant reproduction. They were looking at who's visiting these flowers. When are they flowering? They used nets to cover some of the flowers to prevent pollinators from going to them to see if they're self-pollinating. When are they going to seed? What percentages are going to seed? All that stuff.
Okay.
So each form of pine sap exhibited unique reproductive traits. So for example, I already mentioned there were differences in timing, but also duration of reproductive development. There could be up to 6 to 8 weeks differences in flowering times between the yellow and red forms of pine sap. So it's almost 2 months difference in flowering time.
Yeah.
Right?
And you said there was overlap, but just when it begins,
and when it ends. Yeah. They did find kind of, this is one of the first papers that I came across, that there is specialization on bumblebees with pollinating pine sap. They don't have a high degree of various pollinators, but it seems the ones that come to them the most are bumblebees.
Regardless of the color?
It does seem that yellow attracted the fewest visitations. So bumblebees came to both of them, but they went to the red more. But do you remember I mentioned earlier that yellow tends to self-pollinate?
Yeah, yeah.
So it doesn't need the pollinator as much.
Okay.
It's getting almost so dark where I almost can't read my notes.
It's really impressive.
This is cool.
Or distressing.
Yeah.
We did have a tornado touchdown not too far from here.
Is this another eclipse that we just
like a week ago?
It's getting so dark it does feel like an eclipse.
Yeah, it felt like an eclipse again.
This is crazy.
And we don't feel any rain really yet, so it just got dark.
All right. Now, additionally, 11 microsatellite markers were developed for pine sap. And Steve, what is a microsatellite marker?
So it's these repetitive sequences, either within genes or between coding sequences, and they change kind of at a fast rate. So if you're looking at differences between populations or individuals in recent time, you can't really trust this for like really old events. But in recent time, you can look at these microsatellite markers for differences to tell like what belongs with what and so on. We're hearing the wind a little bit more.
Did
what I say make sense? Did I mention that? I'm talking about DNA?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And when I first read that, I wasn't sure what they were referring to, so I had to dig into it a little bit. But they're figuring out the genetics, and you're saying the recent genetics.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So, yeah, you wouldn't really use this for anything that's, like, super old.
Okay.
But because it changes pretty quickly.
And how's the sound doing? Do you think people can hear what we're saying?
Oh, wow.
The rain is really coming down.
Holy cow. And the trees are going wild, too.
But we're not really feeling too much.
Wow.
Oh, this is
Let's hope we don't get crushed.
Should we go back?
Let's go to the shelter. All right,
folks. We're going
to
run for the shelter.
Okay.
Grant.
Left it a little too late, eh? Whose fault was that?
All right, folks, we are back on the trail.
Yeah.
After hiding in the car.
It's still raining, you know, but...
not like it was.
Yeah.
That was a pretty heavy downpour.
Yeah.
And my favorite part, again, other than Steve's voice of reason there, it got real dark, the wind picked up, we had every single warning to hightail out of here.
The tops of the trees were going crazy.
Yeah, yeah. But we were like, no, and I just really want to see what this is like.
We're going to stick it out.
Yeah. Instant soaked, instant like pools of water. I'm not saying puddles, like this is like pools of water.
Ankle deep.
Yeah,
ankle
deep. It was wild. Yeah.
And it lasted about a half hour.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as I said, we're back on the trail, and now we were talking about the dissertation, and we were looking at the microsatellite markers.
Yeah.
And you were describing how that gives researchers a window into recent genetics.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So
Or I should say, it's a really useful tool when you're trying to figure out what's related to what, especially with populations that diverged in, like, recent times. Yeah.
And what they did find is that this information, it said that genetic structuring between red and yellow color forms was suggestive of speciation.
Oh. Huh.
And that the authors of this paper did recommend a taxonomic revision. Now, there have been a couple other studies that seem to indicate similar findings. And I was surprised because I was looking at different flora online just to find out general information about pine sap. And the North Carolina Botanic Garden, they have an online flora of the southeastern U.S. And they go so far as to list Hypopitus as its own genus now.
Wow. Okay.
And they take it even one step further. They say Hypopitus is a genus of 6 to 10 species. This was the only source online that I found that had anything more than two.
So the big time splitters?
Big time splitters. Wow. And they said recent molecular evidence supports its separation as a genus distinct from Monotropa, and that plants in North America are not the same species with those in Eurasia. They say there are at least 6 species of pine sap present in eastern North America.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just
in eastern North America.
So low and west out near Alaska.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now I want to really look at these papers.
So, as you said, Daniel, they were the hardcore splitters. So, we already talked about how they're members of the family Ericaceae. Listeners might know this group as the Heaths or the Heather family. They're normally found most often in acidic or infertile growing conditions. Think of cranberry, blueberries.
I was going to say, a lot of people don't think about, like, what a heath is.
Right.
It's more like, yeah, blueberry, cranberry, yeah.
And Ericaceae, though, does contain a diverse range of plants, including herbs, dwarf shrubs, shrubs and trees. Now, you were out west for a while. Do you remember the manzanitas? Did you encounter those out there?
No.
So manzanitas, that's a tree that I always think of, like, the desert southwest. Those are also members of Ericaceae. The leaves are usually evergreen.
A tree.
That's
cool.
Yeah. And the name Ericaceae comes from the type genus Erica. That's what is called heath or heather.
Yeah. Hmm.
Now, pine sap was formerly classified in other families, but now it's firmly in Ericaceae. And it's specifically in a subfamily. Let's see if I can say this right. Monotropoidae. Monotropoidae.
I think that sounds right.
So that includes Monotropa, where pine sap and ghost pipe is. But then there's other plants as well, like you mentioned beech drops.
And that's epiphagus, I think, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Members of this family are often referred to, so members of this subfamily, I should say, are all often referred to as monotropes. So not all monotropes are in the genus Monotropa. Now, members, I said members of this family are often referred to as monotropes because they're all achlorophyllous obligate mica heterotrophs.
Okay.
All right. So they're all getting nutrients like pine sap does.
And when
tapping into that mycorrhizal network.
And when Bill says obligate, I know we've probably defined it plenty of times, but that just means it's more or less something, well, they have to do it. It's not what's called facultative, which is like they could either take it or leave it.
Right.
But it's like when something's facultative, it's like they have the capability, but they're not necessarily dependent on it.
Like a lot of carnivorous plants.
Yeah, right.
They're not obligate carnivores.
Yeah, I haven't fed my Venus flytrap in a long time, and it still survives.
It's doing just fine, right? So, pine sap is the most widespread member of this subfamily. I did mention that, right? And that fact, the fact that it's the most widespread member, it does play a role in its relationship to mycorrhizal fungi. Folks, especially if this whole mycorrhizal fungi thing is relatively new to you, we should point out that most mycorrhizal fungi are common mushrooms. And for the monotropes, the specificity of these fungi, they're not just using any fungi that they find in the forest floor.
You know what? Do you know what's funny? When I think of pine sap, they kind of remind me of fungi a little bit too, because I think it's for most of the year, they are, or most of their life cycle, they are essentially underground. They're subterranean, where like that's where all the mycorrhizae are for mushrooms. And then the only thing that comes up for pine sap is the flower, the reproductive body, and then for fungi, that's the only part we see is the mushroom.
You're exactly right.
So it's kind of a really cool fungi-like flower, which or plant, which is really cool.
No, but whenever I'm leading a hike, I try to point out to people that, you know, if you see a mushroom, if you break that mushroom off, you're not killing that mushroom. That mushroom is the network of strands of fungus all through the soil. And it's just sending up that reproductive part. It's like picking an apple off an apple tree.
Well, would it be like picking all the apples off the apple tree?
I would think it's probably sending up more than just that one.
Okay.
Yeah. It would probably depend on the species.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So we were talking about how...
Don't eat mushrooms you find on the trip.
Always good to point out. So generally, a given plant will have only one fungus species on its root system. There's variation by region, but fungi associated with a particular monotrope species, they're usually closely related. And this is where we're going to talk about lineages. We were talking about this a little bit off mic before we started recording. research shows that plant lineages specifically depend on different lineages of fungi. So in the monotrope mycorrhizal symbiosis, so this relationship here, there's one monotrope called pine drops, and there's a different species of fungus, rhizopogon, that's associated with each different lineage. Now, Steve, tell me if I have this right. So when we're talking about lineages within a species, you can say that different populations, like if I have some pine drops here in Western New York versus pine drops, say, in Ohio, even though they're both the same species, they might have historically different genetic ancestors for those populations. Now, if you go far back far enough, yes.
Right. Obviously, they share a common ancestor more recently than either population does with another species.
Right.
But
their genetics are different enough.
Yeah.
Where we can say they have a different lineage.
Right. I mean, for a number of reasons, both like the random and non-random effects of evolution are going to have their effects on each population. So if two populations are separated for long enough, it could even mean speciation.
Right. But in this case, it doesn't. But those different populations with different lineages, they're going to tap in to different species of fungi. They're going to kind of have co-evolved with different species.
It's a cool concept.
So, but the interesting part is those different lineages are tapping into different species, but the species are still related. They might be in the same genus. Okay.
Of fungi.
Correct.
Okay.
So pine drops most often links up with rhizopogon fungus, which if you're a mushroom person out there, folks, you may know it as false truffles.
Oh.
Okay.
Rhizopogon sounds familiar, but I think that pogon is also something that is in some genus that I know for plants. I don't know.
It's been shown that stimulation by rhizopogon fungus may be necessary for germination of pine drop seeds. Okay? Now, pine drops, that is not the species we're focusing on this episode, but I just make this point. A relative of the plant we're looking at, pine sap.
Pine sap and pine drops, yeah.
I know.
Sorry, guys.
Some research is indicating that pine drops, if the seeds are in a good place to grow, if there is none of this rhizopogon fungus in the soil, it's not going to germinate. Which is kind of crazy, right?
Yeah.
Because it knows it won't have a reliable energy source?
Well, we're not sure exactly why. So this might mean that it's also necessary for other monotropes, like pine sap, the one we're talking about today, to have the fungus in the soil, even for the seeds just to start growing, for them to germinate, that this fungus needs to be present.
You know, can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
How far are pine sap seeds going? Are they just dropping where the plant already is?
No, they're usually windblown.
They're windblown.
They're
okay.
Tiny. They're like dust.
Oh.
They're very, very tiny.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So that capsule has slits in it.
So there are a lot of tiny little seeds, and they're going to get blown around. And if it happens to land in the right patch of soil with the right type of fungi growing in the soil, that's what we're saying. Maybe that's what it takes for germination.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Right. That's good to know, because I could not picture how the seeds looked. So,
sure.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to get it too deep into this, because I can see Daniel's eyes glazing over here. But
it's me, not you, Bill.
No, I think it's me. But there's really two different kinds of mycorrhizal fungi. One's called endomycorrhizal, and one's called ectomycorrhizal, that I think it's important that we talk about. So, endo and ecto, what do those mean? What do those prefixes mean?
In and out.
Yes, there we go. Basically. So endo means in, ecto means out. So mycorrhizal fungi, if it's endomycorrhizal, that means part of the fungus, strands of the fungus, are actually entering the cells of the plant that it's attaching to. Okay. In ectomycorrhizal, and that's what pine sap is tapping into, it doesn't actually enter as deep into the cell. There is some puncturing of cell walls.
Wait, is the mushroom? Is the fungus going into the pine sap, or is the pine sap going into the fungus?
The fungus is going into the pine sap.
Okay.
All right.
Isn't this what we call a rhizobium? Is that what it is?
Oh, I don't know.
There is a plant physiology term for this, and because it does form the fungi and the plant does form like a special structure. It doesn't just invade.
That's what I'm talking about.
There's an actual structure that's created.
That's what I'm getting to.
Okay.
You're reading my mind.
Yeah.
So in the relationship between pine sap and its mycorrhizal fungi, these ectomycorrhizal fungus, strands of the fungus hit the root and they go between the cells. Mm-hmm. But they also form this net of fungus around it. It's called a Hartig net. It's named after this German botanist. So if we could dig up a pine sap plant and look at the roots, we actually could barely even see the roots. They'd be covered in a sheath of this fungus.
Wow.
And that's actually where one of its names comes from.
Isn't it kind of strange that the roots of the fungus is attaching to the pine sap and the pine sap is stealing energy from
it? Right, it does.
That doesn't make sense to me.
It is not 100% clear. I did see some studies that did say they found when they would put markers into the pine sap, they would sometimes find those in trees nearby that were also connected to that network.
Yeah.
So we're not 100% sure what exactly is going on. Right now, it's generally agreed that pine sap is taking from this network, but we're not sure if and how much it might be providing.
Yeah, like I was just saying, like, so that would mean then that the fungus is getting something from the pine sap and the tree is getting that from the fungus,
and
potentially.
Then is it really a parasite? But right now,
I think it's a messy three-way.
Steve knows all about those. So what if one benefits, a little bit, but is still also kind of harmed, and the other one just benefits. Is that like a different kind of parasitism?
Remember, just complex? all of these symbioses. It's a range. Not very clearly.
It's not, okay.
Because right? I could imagine a scenario, and I'm not going to go into any detail, obviously, because I didn't dig into this. But I can imagine a mutualism between the fungus and the tree, but something else between.
Parasitism.
Parasitism right, with extra benefits.
Pine sap is like a really crappy boyfriend. He's maybe giving a little bit, but he's taking way
more. Allow me to tag in here.
But is the fungi benefiting from the pine sap?
Right. Right now.
Okay, that's what we don't. So this is where everything kind of gets confusing. We don't know what the relationship necessarily is between. Because what if it's just a mistake that the fungi is also, I say like mistake in air quotes, that it's also going into the pine sap? Because the pine sap doesn't have those sugars to help the fungus out, you know?
Well,
maybe it's just one of those things like a mistake of evolutionary history. This relationship has been going on for a long time.
It would make sense that the fungus might get something out of it if it's the one that's initiating the connection. Right. We were talking about the fungus going into the pine sap.
But what does fungus typically get from photosynthetic trees, right, or other plants? Usually get some form of like sugar, energy in the form of sugar. But Monotropa can't give that. So,
but the fungi might just be finding a seed and tapping into it, not knowing, you know, what it is.
So it's getting into an unhealthy relationship blindly. Okay, right. Got it.
I
don't want to overstate for the audience that there's confusion about this. Like,
Okay.
Like, if you talk to any professional botanist, people studying pine sap, they're going to say, this is a parasite.
Yeah.
Right now, most of what we're seeing points to the fact that pine sap is taking. It's not really giving anything.
Okay.
I saw a couple studies that found that, hey, when they put a marker into pine sap, it showed up in nearby trees. We can't say that means pine sap's giving anything.
Yeah.
Okay? The trees are connected. Right? So I don't want to overstate this confusion
now. That is interesting, though.
Yeah.
I do think it's worth saying what Bill just said. It's still considered a parasite, so clearly it's benefiting.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem to be giving a whole lot, if anything.
Well, more than benefiting if it's obligate, right?
Like, yeah.
Right.
Okay. It has to do it. So I want to talk about a study that took place in England where there's a symbiotic relationship between a species of willow, creeping willow, and the Tricholoma fungus. That is the genus that is most often associated with pine sap. That's the one that pine sap has co-evolved with to tap into. Okay. Now, if you're familiar with Matsutake mushrooms, they're a Tricholoma. Now, pine sap plants tap into this relationship, and the study wanted to see if pine sap seeds grew better close to willow species that the Tricholoma fungus attaches to, or if they grew better also closer to mature pine sap plants. They're just trying to see. So I was more interested in, does pine sap require the fungus to be present? And they got some evidence of this indirectly, because they were just looking to see, hey, does pine sap grow better closer to existing pine sap plants? Does it grow better growing closer to these willow trees that the fungus is related to? Now, what they had to do, because these seeds were so tiny and dust-like, they would gather the seeds and they would put them into these mesh bags with soil in them, and then they planted these in plots all over, hundreds of them. They buried them in September and October, and then they went back and harvested them at different times. So some they harvested at 7 months, some at 9, some at 14 months, some at 21, and some 26 months after sowing. And what they did, they looked at all the seeds, how they developed, and they developed the seed development into 5 stages. So stage 0 was no development at all. It's just the seed that we put in. Stage 4 was when the seedling was pretty far along and had side roots and a main stem, and it was usually enveloped in that mantle of fungi that I talked about. The earliest stage of germination, which they called stage 1, this is when they could see some cell division happening within the seed, but it hadn't broken out of the seed coat yet. That was found without the mature pine sap plants or the willows close by. But any further development beyond that was dependent on the fungus being present. Okay. So if we want to answer the question, does pine sap require mycorrhizal fungi for germination? The authors were careful to say, the present study provides only indirect information on this aspect. Then they go on to talk about how in plots where there were no mycorrhizal colonization, the fungus wasn't present, only about 0.7% of seeds reached stage 1.
Wow.
So less than 1%. If there's no fungus present, less than
1%. And that's just reaching stage 1.
And that's the seed, nothing's even broken out of the seed yet. And there was no further development after that.
Wow.
That was in the first 13 to 14 months.
Wow. Okay.
So even those, the ones that did reach that little bit of division, that stage 1, there was no further development after it. It's like they started and then they stopped because there was no fungus present. It's likely that the requirement for early fungal colonization comes from the fact that in those pine sap seeds, those tiny seeds, the nutritional resource for the tiny embryo plant for the support of seedling development consists of only 9 cells. Nine cells! That's it. That's all that's in there. While it seems seeds can start to germinate without their fungal partners, and that's even rare when that happens, they also can't rule out that the fungus may still be involved in those cases. Not by coming into contact with the seeds, but they hypothesized maybe there's even chemical signals just in the soil.
Okay?
And they talked about this because there's some evidence from some orchid species where orchid seed germination was stimulated by fungi before they even penetrated the seeds. Okay. So a lot of orchids rely on mycorrhizal fungus as well. So there's been some information, some studies that have said, hey, just being in the soil but not actually coming in contact with the seed
is enough. So it's detecting its presence in a different way, not just direct contact.
Right.
So they say,
like chemical signaling, so, so this, like secondary compounds in the soil.
This study makes it clear that any seedling development beyond the first few cell divisions has an absolute dependence upon colonization by a specific fungal partner. Since seedlings that reach stage 1 yet fail to become colonized die, and those that form mycorrhizal associations develop normally, there seems to be every reason for referring to the germination process overall as being symbiotic, as needing that fungus.
Okay. Wow.
So pine sap needs it.
Well, okay. Yeah.
All right. Now, I don't have much left, but I want to do two things. One, I want us to do a little bit of searching for pine sap.
Oh, yeah.
But we also have to do our shout-out to Gumleaf.
Yeah.
Gumleaf makes Wellington-style natural rubber boots for men and women, and you'll find people using them along rivers and streams, in duck and turkey blinds, botanizing and birding in woods, ponds, and fields just as easily as you will find them on the sidelines of soccer fields on a wet day, in stables, and on farms. The Gumleaf factory in Europe has been manufacturing rubber boots since 1937. They are well-designed, with all of the features found in styles nearly twice their cost. Visit Gumleaf USA to view their styles for men and women, and remember that patrons of the podcast receive free shipping on any order.
All right, so what do you guys say we do some looking for pine sap?
Let's take a walk.
All right. And I'm hoping we'll come across that other plant.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not going to tell you what it is.
Oh, cancer root?
Yeah.
We were just talking about it, actually.
We were talking
about
when you guys went for a ride.
I saw some on the trail.
Oh,
right,
did
trail,
you?
Yeah.
Okay. There is a ton of it in here. So this is another parasitic plant, but this is a broom rape. This is not a monotrope.
Yeah, there was some right next to us where we were recording.
Have you guys ever seen, like, it is
I've never seen it like this,
in this wood.
No.
all over in this wood.
Yeah, you look, like, as soon as we got here, you look around and it's all over the place.
There's lots of patches out
there.
So I did a little research yesterday because I saw it when we were scouting. It does normally associate with oaks and beech.
Okay.
This patch of woods here, there is a kind of an abnormal number of oaks and beeches for woods in Western New York.
Yeah, we don't really get much in the way of oaks, especially. Yeah. I mean, beeches, pretty common. Oaks, not so much. I mean, see them, but...
They're around, yeah. But yeah. There seems to be a high concentration of beech and oaks.
Like, when I was living out west, oaks everywhere, right? But here, you know,
and here's,
not as much as maple beech hardwoods, you know.
And here's ghost pipe. We're finding ghost pipe.
Oh, yeah. Almost stepped on some.
So, these are white. Just one flower.
Mm-hmm.
But... In iNaturalist, this patch of woods right here, there were two sightings over the past couple years.
Yeah.
They have photo uploads?
They did.
So it's verified.
For people that that maybe don't know what either of these look like, for some reason when I think of like the scales up the stalk of the ghost pipe, I think of like an asparagus.
Okay.
But white.
You're right.
But it's the head of it's different, you know, but
yes.
But I think of asparagus sort of gives me the feeling
those
of...
Those scales on asparagus. Yeah, yeah. They're kind of shaped similarly. They kind of sit on the stem the same way.
Yeah.
That's a good analogy.
But they got a bend in it like a candy cane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Once turned.
One turn.
What'd you find, Daniel?
Wood frog.
Ooh, a wood frog.
That's a little one.
Holy moly, yeah.
So Daniel's found a wood frog that's about the size of a penny. All right, so while we're looking, I just have one more thing I want to share. This was a paper that I found from 2015, and this was interesting because it wasn't a study so much as a letter. It was in the American Journal of Botany, and it was just talking about a hypothesis that some researchers had. And the title of this was called Parasitism Disruption, a likely consequence of below-ground war waged by an exotic plant invader.
Oh, okay.
So, they started off by talking about a common invasive plant that I know we all know, Aliaria petiolata. Do you remember?
I can't remember what this genus is.
From your botany days?
No, can I see the way it's spelled?
All right, Daniel, Aliaria petiolata.
I cannot remember what Aliaria is.
Garlic mustard.
Oh, garlic mustard.
Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, I know we've all encountered...
It's tasty.
...garlic mustard before. It's in abundance in a lot of North American understories like the one we're in, although I don't see a lot of it here. Yeah. It has high reproductive output, it has a lot of shade tolerance, and most herbivores don't like it, except for Steve. But its wide success is largely credited to its novel chemical weapons. Specifically, there's two classes of compounds with antifungal properties.
Oh.
So, can you... kind of predict where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
Where?
Well, it's going to disrupt this the middleman in these parasitism relationships.
Exactly. So there's been some research that's shown that North American mycorrhizae that haven't co-evolved with garlic mustard are highly sensitive to garlic mustard's chemical cocktail. So that means garlic mustard can disrupt this mutualism that kind of forms the basis, the foundation for most of our forests, right? This mycorrhizal network.
Wow.
And it can impact it. There's two big ways. There's a bunch of ways, but two big ones are it could hamper the formation of new connections between native plants and mycorrhizae, and it could diminish the effectiveness of existing connections. Now, we were talking about how important the fungus is for pine sap, but it's similarly necessary for forest tree seedlings, for their growth and survival.
So one thing I was just about to ask, do you recall, when I think of garlic mustard, maybe just because of a lot of the areas I've seen it in, is it more of like an edge
it
lover?
Does
like,
very yeah. often grow on the edge.
Okay.
But one of the problems with it is it can grow into the forest.
Oh, okay. So it can be like an understory.
Yes.
Okay.
And for, you know, the past couple hundred years, so many of our invasive plants were plants more of the open.
Yeah.
But plants like honeysuckle, mm-hmm. plants like garlic mustard are now starting to invade understories. Where we already have a problem with too many deer, right?
So, see, in the spring, there's a lot of things that seem like edges with the with the light, you know, still being there. So
true. So forest tree seedlings, as I was saying, they need those mycorrhizal connections for growth and survival. There's a lot of research that shows when grown in garlic mustard-impacted soils, tree seedlings produce less biomass. They're less healthy. There's less of them. There's lots of other impacts. I'm not going to get into all of them, but it all represents forms of what's called mutualism disruption. That's what garlic mustard is doing. This is a known concept that's actively being studied. But what this particular paper, the one from 2015, what they hypothesized is that this mutualism disruption is unlikely to only affect the relationship between mycorrhizal plants and their typical partners, the trees and other mycorrhizal plants. This breakdown in network will also impact parasitic plants, like pine sap, who tap into the network, plants engaged in mycoheterotrophy. So they're saying that this mutualism disruption due to garlic mustard could function as parasitism disruption too, leading to reduced chances for mycoheterotrophs to capture carbon and nutrients. So this could impact already established individuals, pine saps and ghost pipes in these populations, and recruitment of new individuals. And when we talk about recruitment in botany, Steve, what does that mean?
I don't...
Recruitment, you know, just new plants growing, right?
Sure, yeah.
You know that, I know you.
I hit a mental block really quick.
Just remember, so I focused a lot on how important the fungus is for germination and success of pine sap seeds, right? Mm-hmm. So just imagine if that network wasn't there. Right?
Is that to the advantage of the garlic mustard, or is that like a secondary consequence to the chemicals that the garlic mustard has?
I would say the garlic mustard impacting pine saps and monotropes, that's secondary.
That's just secondary.
Because there's not a lot of direct competition there, right?
So what do the chemicals, the purpose serve just as far as the garlic mustard's concerned?
Making room for the garlic mustard,
right? Kind of like
what
happens with black walnuts, in a way?
Yeah. Okay. So pine sap, we're not too worried about because it is so widespread.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a plant that most people are concerned about in most areas, even though it's rare or scarce overall, it's doing fairly well. But a plant like pine drops, one of its relatives, in the eastern U.S., it's been recorded in less than 20 locations since 1970.
Wow.
Whoa.
With just a handful of populations in New England. So as garlic mustard spread, like that could potentially wipe out one of those populations.
I was just about to say, if this was noticed at about the time garlic mustard began to dominate.
That's right.
Yeah. And if they linked, wow.
Now,
jeez.
I read this letter, and I'm like, whoa, that's something interesting, something I want to talk about. It's concerning. It's not impacting pine sap a big deal, but as relatives, it's, you know, just something interesting to talk about. But that led me to some other papers that talked about, like, and this is one of the things I love about science, but it's also frustrating about, especially botanical science and ecology, people saying, hold on. This letter talking about parasitism disruption presented the evidence of garlic mustard and its negative impacts on the fungal network as solid, that this is what always happens. But when you start to look at, especially more recent papers, looking at garlic mustard and its impacts just on forests in general and on the mycorrhizal network in particular, it's highly variable. There's some papers out there that say, look, in these areas with this particular mix of plants, it doesn't have much of an impact. But in these other areas with this other mix of plants, or even the same mix of plants, it does have an impact.
So they produce different levels of these chemicals.
Right. So it's very much a gray area. Yeah. And just saying
like everything
that,
else.
Like garlic mustard, it's going to kill all the monotropes.
Right.
That's overstating it and oversimplifying it. Now, I did, you know, I spent a couple hours trying to look at papers since 2020 looking at garlic mustard and its impacts. And I will say, again, I'm not a professional. This is just my, you know, quote-unquote research.
Mm-hmm.
The longer we do this podcast, the more reluctant I am to use that word research. Because I'm not doing what real researchers are doing. I'm just looking at stuff.
You could call it a lit review, you know. I mean,
sure.
It's fine.
Most of the papers that I saw did seem to lean in, garlic mustard does have negative impacts overall. It's not something we want to see spreading through our forests.
Right.
It was interesting, though. I did find one paper that said that garlic mustard keeps other invasive species at bay. So,
interesting.
If you're worried about a different invasive species. But overall, I kind of want to wrap up just by saying that it's a gray area, it's complicated, but it's definitely something to be aware of, especially if you're dealing with populations like pine drops where you have threatened or endangered species, and it's good to be aware of what potential risks could be on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And that was everything that I had on pine sap.
But it's not everything. So I'm not going to talk about many things here, but so with a bit of my research, I work with carnivorous plants. Mm-hmm. And one of the kind of a fun thing about carnivorous plants is that their genomes are kind of weird. Because, like, for example, when you think of something like a bladderwort. So, you know, bladderworts have these little subterranean or aquatic bladders, and they capture, you know,
I just
little...
talked about them Friday with the kids.
Yeah, yeah. So
they
bladder...
suck in
yeah, they
critters.
They suck in little critters, and then they digest them, and that's where they get a lot of their nutrients from. So utricularia, or bladderworts, don't really have roots. So why do you need the genes for roots? So their genomes are really reduced. So they've lost a lot of their genes that, like, every other plant in the world has to create roots. And often in the literature, you see them being compared to parasitic plants, because parasitic plants have also lost up to, like, 50% of the genes in their genome. So there have been some genome papers about parasitic plants, and they're like, and this might not mean anything to you, but I'll expand a little bit. One of the ones that I was reading about, it looks like Rafflesia, but it's a lot smaller. It's in that same group.
What is Rafflesia?
Rafflesia, it's like that big reddish-orange flower that you've seen pictures of that, it's just, let's just say, there's a parasitic plant called Rafflesia that's a big, beautiful flower.
Someone
that's pretty
that
much
smells
the,
really bad?
I believe it, yes.
Okay.
That's one of
flower?
Them. It's not the corpse flower.
Oh,
that's Amorphophallus.
Okay.
That's different. That's an arum. But, So that one only has 13,000 genes in its genome, and the typical number is closer to, like, 26,000 genes. So it has, like, half the number of genes you'd expect it to have, but that's because it doesn't need to have genes that for any part of its body plan, pretty much other than creating a flower. And there are some expansions in its, like, root generating genes, but that's to create something called, like, haustoria, which is the thing that invades the plant that it's parasitic on, the host plant. So there's a lot of really, really interesting things to say about parasitic plants, like the fact that it independently evolved, like, at least 12 times within the plant kingdom. It's like, it's not just one closely related group of plants that are all parasitic. There's a ton of them, and they all independently evolved this mechanism for survival. And also that haustoria thing that I mentioned before, the thing that invades the host plant, that also independently evolved in a number of different lineages. And there's also a really, really cool phenomenon called horizontal gene transfer that happens between parasites and their hosts. So there are some genes that have no business being in some of these host plants, but they're found in the parasites that are on them, and they've been transferred back and forth. And also sometimes, you know, when we think about genomes, we don't just think about nuclear genomes, like where, you know, when we talk about 23andMe, humans have 23 pairs of chromosomes. So that's like a nuclear genome, but in plants there's also a chloroplast genome. And why would you need a chloroplast genome, you know, if you're not doing much photosynthesizing? Now there
is
are
their ancestors might have, is that
it? They could have it, but there are some, like that Rafflesia one, that's lost the chloroplast genome. It just no longer has it. So that's not something that's very common in the plant kingdom, is that you would lose, you know, you would lose a whole genome, you know, this chloroplast genome. So I will say there's a lot of really, really, really interesting topics when it comes to parasites that, and they're even different than what we talked about today, because some of them, I don't think they all require fungi.
Right.
Yeah, so some of these are directly from plant to plant. And I think that haustoria thing, that maybe if someone came into this episode knowing something about parasitic plants, we didn't talk about that at all, because it just doesn't seem to be something that pine sap has anything to do with. It didn't evolve this type of structure.
Right, so pine sap and relatives are just using one form, mycoheterotrophy.
Yeah, so I will say this would be a really fun topic to continue doing, you know, research on, mm-hmm. Lit reviews on, but because it's out of
research,
it's because it's out of my wheelhouse as well. It's just tangentially related to some of the work that I've done, but yeah, I just wanted to say that right at the very end that there's a lot of really exciting things that maybe in the future we could talk about, but I just wanted to give a short little preview of it here. So,
all right.
Yeah.
So we're going to start today's wrap up with a shout out to Shannon Briggs. She was someone who emailed us about our YouTube feed because recently, Google Podcasts stopped hosting podcasts, and we've shifted over to YouTube. We hadn't had a YouTube channel before, so we're recording this right now in July of 2024. And prior to a few months ago, we weren't really a presence on YouTube. We had a few videos up there, but
like
not much.
Oh, the tick dragging video?
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I did move all of our episodes over there. So if YouTube is a place you get your podcasts, you can now find us there. Shannon had emailed to say that she couldn't find us easily. That when she put in the field guides, she couldn't find us. And that there was some problem with our RSS feed. So I was able to go in, and even though I have no idea what I'm doing with RSS feeds, I was able to set it up. So we are now on YouTube. Our entire channel is on YouTube.
Nice.
Almost all of our shows, there's a few glitches with a couple shows, but almost our entire catalog is up there. So check us out on YouTube, and thank you, Shannon, for pointing that out to us.
Yeah, that'll surely be easier for people to get to certain episodes than it is on our website, for example.
Yes. So.
All right, and so we would also like to thank our growing list of Patreon supporters. So thank you to our new patrons, Picasso3, Jen D, and Mark T. We also like to give a special shout-out each month to our top patrons, so stick around to the end of the episode to hear Bill's daughter, Violet, share that list. And remember, if you'd like to be part of the field guides and read our Patreon list, which I don't think anyone's done yet.
No, we've had a couple.
We've had a couple.
Oh, yeah.
We've had a couple people do. My memory, sorry. But if you want to be that person that reads the name in a future episode, just email us at thefieldguides@gmail.com. And if you'd like to support the podcast, consider becoming a patron of our show at patreon.com. As a patron, you'll get access to special patron-only versions of our episodes that include Bill sharing the episode notes. Because of support from our listeners, we've been able to keep the show free and make cooler episodes like the Insectapalooza episode. Or you can make a one-time donation through PayPal on our website.
And don't forget that we have Field Guides merch available through our website store at thefieldguidespodcast.com. And remember, if you can't financially support the podcast, you can help out by sharing it with friends and family and by subscribing and leaving us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps spread the word and allows us to reach a wider audience. We'd also like to thank our newest iTunes reviewers, Greenfield05.
And remember to get those kids outside. Let them get muddy and dirty or snowy, and let them flip over rocks and logs. And if you don't have kids, try to make some time to get yourself outside. And folks, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Bye, everybody.
And here is Violet getting ready to read our top patrons for this month. But we wanted to warn everybody in advance. There may be some background noise. We are actually on vacation in the Cayman Islands. So we are on the porch. This is the best we could do as a place to record. So there might be traffic going by. There may be the sounds of feral chickens in the background as well. And Violet also may be suffering from hiccups. All right, Violet, take it away. Our top patrons are...
Eric, Alyssa, Adam, the Hebranks, Mary, Sung, Dr. Judy, Kimberly B, Peter R, Callie, Rich K, Jessica, Orange Julianne, Daniel M, Diane, we named the dog Indy, Hot Dog Cold Weather, Dwayne, Jennifer D, Jonathan A, Picasso 3, Mark T, Cecilia, Julie B, Dennis, Leslie, Chris N, Jeff S, Colin G, M. Tulan, Brant S, Jonathan K, Matt E, Plants in My Pants, Sean M, Brian R, Sophie S, Connor H, Measure and Principle, Fragaria Pephaloinoidea, Outside Chronicles, Andrew C, Quixote, Max D, Melissa Marie in Dusty Arizona, Kelly S, Sarah S, Helen, Judy F, Ben C, Jane, DoodleDude82, Galen Mac, Kazzies, Jeff S, Esther, John W, Mark V, Bethany H, Rob M, Hannah M A.
Well done.
Thank you.
And no hiccups.
Yay!
All right. Thank you, Violet.
You're welcome.
And patrons, thank you. On behalf of Daniel, myself, and Steve, we appreciate all your support. It really does mean the world to us. See you next time.
Bye.